think I should begin. Those of you weren't here before, I've given two or three lectures all about the terrible things that happen on this earth. And the last one was meteorites crashing in and something more to worry about. And I thought, when I woke up this morning, I thought, I'm like Jonah. I'm the reason that all this is, all these terrible things could happen to the earth. So maybe I ought to jump ship. But it actually occurred to me walking over here down these beautiful grounds that the title of my talk, I think, today was The Impact That Human Activity Can Have on the Earth. And that's generally assumed in the context of what I was supposed to talk about, global warming, all the things that we're doing is not good for the earth or ourselves. It occurred to me that there are a few things that humans do on a large scale in over historic time that aren't all bad. And Katie and I and our children were in England in the 1980s. I was at a seminar on the ancient earth at Oxford, and afterward we went down to the coast to Lyme Regis, and then we went up to the Lake District, and just, you know, the whole country is beautiful. It's a garden. But on the way from Oxford down to Lyme Regis, we stopped and had dinner in a restaurant that was built out of old ship's timbers. So it's something like this room. And it made you realize that in the age of sailing, England was forested like the land outside here, and essentially deforested it during those several centuries. And but it's interesting now that people from this country go to England to go on garden tours. And that's largely because the English people who live on the land have taken care of it. Now, if there had been an environmental protection agency and Forest Service and all the environmental groups that we have today back during the sailing days, there would have been a tremendous human cry about what you're doing in this country. And now you could make the case that England is not contributing as much as it should to the trapping of carbon dioxide, because it could really have more forests. But it does have a lot of plant life, and it's there because individual English people tend their gardens, and it's just beautiful. So not everything that we do is bad, but I guess my lecture today is the things that we're doing that are probably not good. I just have three slides today, so it won't be this sensory overload that I've had in previous lectures. And this is the first one. Scientists by the name of Keeling back in the 1950s became concerned about carbon dioxide, which makes only about 0.04% of the atmosphere. There's only about 385 parts per million carbon dioxide in the atmosphere at the present time. But I imagine you're all aware of the fact that carbon dioxide, water, methane are gases that when ultraviolet light, the energy from the sun, passes through it, comes to Earth, it is not scattered by those molecules. So that's why we have bright sunlight. However, when that energy heats up rocks, soils, and everything else, it radiates it back into space, not as ultraviolet radiation, but as infrared radiation, a radiation that we associate with heat. And that does agitate those molecules. The electrons around the atoms, not to go into that, but are essentially excited. It's a good word for it, but it means that they're moving faster in the electrical conductivity that the electrons provide in the cloud of the carbon and the oxygen that hold that molecule together, vibrate much faster. And they do calm down and they re-radiate. But if the heat is coming up from the Earth and hits the atmosphere and they absorb it all, when they re-emit it, they re-emit it in 360 degrees. They don't re-emit the full beam. So a large part, over half of it, comes back to Earth. And of course, that's the greenhouse effect. So this is why Keeling was concerned about how much are volcanoes contributing to the atmosphere, and how much in the worldwide industrial world that we live in, how much is human activity contributing. Now, it's always seemed to me a paradox that he would have gone to Hawaii, where there are active eruptions. However, the eruptions there, compared to Mount St. Helens, are very low, even when there is an eruption, in steam and carbon dioxide. But he went there because it's in the middle of the ocean, far away from industrial activity, and it's at a high elevation, so he could sample the lower part of the upper atmosphere at about 11,000 feet, and he of course sampled it when there wasn't an eruption. So he was getting the average carbon dioxide content of the average global atmosphere when the CO2 circulates from different sources. And he made his first measurements in 1957. And you see, at that time, there was a little over 310 parts per million. And you'll notice that these go up and down on a very short time scale when we're putting a decade over this distance. And the scale is expanded over here to show the effect of photosynthesis, of plant growth in the northern hemisphere, where plants use CO2 in their life cycle the way we use oxygen. And so as we move into the summer, beginning in May, June, we get a reduction of the CO2. And then in the fall, when the chlorophyll, which is an important molecule in this reaction that requires light to combine carbon dioxide and water into an organic molecule like cellulose, that, and it requires this molecule of chlorophyll, which is green. During this time, all the leaves are green, and the natural color of the leaf is not green. In the fall, as the temperature goes down and the chlorophyll is no longer produced, then the natural color of the leaves come out. So you can see that between 1960 and presently, these measurements were continued after Keeling did the initial work. It's continually going up from about 310 to 390, so that's about 80 parts per million. And there is now a tremendous argument of, is this due to our industrialized age and our burning of coal and our burning of fossil fuels? And I thought there's so much of that. If you imagine most of you use the internet, and if you Google global warming, you'll get all kinds of articles. And there's a recent one in a The New York Review of Books, which you can also access through Google. And there's an article in the June 12th issue of this year by a physicist, Freeman Dyson, who tries to explore both the sides of the debate, that it's clearly an effect of human activity, with those who believe, well, wait a minute, 10,000 years ago we had an ice age. We see all the evidence here in this valley of the melting of the ice, the water running out from the melted ice sheets. And so we have been in an interglacial period. And when I started in geology in 1958, and you took a course in glaciology, the question was, we must be coming back because of the length of time that we've been in this interglacial period. So is there a natural cycle in the distribution of carbon dioxide and methane and water in the atmosphere that is more important than the human activity? Well, the consensus view of the peer-reviewed science is that you can separate those two effects out, and the human input is, if you go back for other records rather than just the CO2 you can actually measure, you find that this continues to go down and is quite flat. And you can actually make direct measurements on the carbon dioxide in the air 150,000 years ago in the ice, 15,000 years ago, in the ice in Antarctica. I have to get this straight. Greenland. I don't believe they've drilled in Antarctica. They could do it, but in Greenland they've drilled down through more than 7,000 or 8,000 feet of ice. In that ice, small bubbles of air are trapped. And just as you can read tree rings, you can get the age of the ice by the layers between summer and fall when the dust from the atmosphere settles over the time when there's not a lot of snowfall in the summer, and so it marks these layers. Actually, come to think of it, I think it goes back to actually 250,000 years now, the latest information that they have. Well, so look in Google and decide for yourself. It seems to me that we know that we are, every time we burn a gallon of gasoline, we're taking something that 10, 100, 200 million years, 300 million years ago was either a living plant or animal, probably marine, and this reaction took place to form that organism. We formed some sort of protein or cellulose. It's stored in the rocks, and we are now taking it out, and we are doing the reverse reaction of combining gasoline with oxygen and producing CO2 and water out of the back of your exhaust pipe. So it seems to me that it behooves us to attempt to minimize this. This is a model of the chlorophyll molecule. And I put this in here for anybody that was at the earlier lectures. The interior of the Earth consists of a principal mineral, olivine, that has a lot of magnesium. And the core element in chlorophyll, interestingly enough, is magnesium, surrounded by oxygen, carbon, and nitrogen. And this is what made it possible in the early history of the solar system, once the Earth was formed, for oxygen to increase in the atmosphere. At about 2 billion years, we believe that the cyanobacteria, which you can put carbon dioxide plus water, plus the need to make life, goes to cyanobacteria. That is a photosynthetic reaction which was constantly increasing the oxygen in the atmosphere. And we believe that the iron formations that I talked about yesterday, in connection with the meteorite impact which killed the cyanobacteria, that they were sufficiently abundant in the oceans of the day to oxidize the iron in a form that it would precipitate out of the water. One of the experiments that we do in the classroom to illustrate that is, you can take iron sulfate, which in days when the batteries used to corrode, around that you would get not just copper sulfide, but iron sulfide. It would dissolve in water and keep your battery clean by dissolving that salt. But if you pour hydrogen peroxide in there, you immediately get a cloud of red precipitate, which is a very fine mineral hematite, oxidized iron. The cyanobacteria were making that possible, and when they were in the Lake Superior region, exterminated by the meteorite impact, they had no more iron formation. Well, that's an aside. Burning of fossil fuels, coal and oil, are taking things where this reaction stored cellulose and protein, and now we're putting it up in the atmosphere. But the complexity of the place where carbon and oxygen are combined to form minerals or to form organic materials, where the CO2 resides as a gas, not combined with any other elements, very complex. And your reading of this is just as good as mine. I took this again off the web to simply show that in numbers of billions of tons per year, what is the storage of the total amount in the Earth's atmosphere? 750. So these are just useful to compare that in the vegetation you have about 610, almost as much as you have in the atmosphere. And you have CO2 dissolved in the ocean, all that complex material, and one place where you get sort of permanent storage is when calcium dissolved in the ocean combines with CO2 and forms the element calcite, which is the principal element in limestone. And that settles down here. We have limestones that go back to billions of years. There are limestone layers in the rocks here at Holden that are only 100 million years old. So there's been a constant cycling, even from rocks, other than just oil and coal and so forth. I guess the point I wanted to make with all this is that there is a complex set of geologic processes that controls the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. And it's unfortunate that there are some scientists who, seeing that first curve we showed, have assumed that we have to take drastic measures to slow down our production of CO2. And that is, instead of there being a consensus view on that, we have people fighting and arguing with us, not just on an individual scale where you can't do much, but on a political scale where all the nations have gathered together several times to write a treaty, or the most important one being in Japan, where it was agreed that everyone would try to reduce their emissions. And the United States, both Democrats and Republicans, refused to join that because they didn't feel that the countries who were not participating would continue to produce more CO2 than we did, and we would essentially destroy our economy if all of a sudden extreme version would be that would be illegal to manufacture a gas-burning car. That of course would never happen here, but that would be, say, an extreme view of what the treaty might require us to do. So I don't know, I'd be interested in hearing from any of you on what do you think our national policy should be. Ben, why don't you describe the fact that he has no investment in this company, but you can buy a little gadget that will reduce the amount of gas you burn to get a certain number of miles.
Well, it's just something I saw on the internet, and several people, not necessarily scientists either, they're more or less automotive tinkers, at least one of them that I read about, who came up with a system that you could electrolyze water and get hydrogen and oxygen from it, combine it with the gasoline that you're burning, and raise the miles per gallon between 50 and 80%. And they give the information to make these devices yourself. When you bring it up on the internet, there are quite a few people that have found out about this. There are even some that are publishing or bringing an internet site that rates the various ones that are out there. It is something, of course, that the petroleum industry doesn't appreciate. But,
did you try one personally, or you just run
it? Pardon?
Did you try it personally, or you?
No, I haven't tried it personally.
But you did get the plans, right?
I did get the plans. I could try it. Takes some time. Takes some materials. But it isn't expensive either. It's less than $100 worth of materials. When you consider the rate of difference in the gasoline burn.
So how many miles to the gallon?
They say between 50 and 80.
Percent.
And reduction in CO2?
No, that's miles per gallon.
Miles per gallon?
Miles per gallon. And the thing about it is, it varies with the engine that you're using it on. They claim it will work on any internal combustion engine, whether it's gasoline or diesel.
Is it a comparable reduction in CO2?
Well, it is because the oxygen and hydrogen, when it ignites with the gasoline, it ignites at a much higher temperature than gasoline does. So what they claim is that the gasoline, as we are used to it in automobiles, use about 20 to 30% of the energy in the gasoline,
yeah.
And the rest of it goes up the tailpipe.
Right, it's inefficient.
It's inefficient.
So the proportional.
So what they're claiming is that the oxygen and hydrogen, when it ignites with the gasoline, raises that percentage of use of the gasoline itself.
Like
I
say,
it varies with the engine, you know, as to how efficient it is.
I thought you had to put energy in to electrolyze.
You do.
You do.
Use the 12 volts off the battery to electrolyze the water.
The we wrote the reaction. CO2 plus water going to C6 H12O6 plus 6O2. You'll notice a similarity here that you take the carbon dioxide and you produce this and you get oxygen. Now this takes sunlight, and so it takes energy and chlorophyll. Now you can use an electric current, and so if you have a beaker full of water and you have two electrodes and you have this connected to a battery, you can bubble off these two gases off these electrodes, but you do have to use the energy. But your car is moving, and so you can use the some of the energy. It would be comparable. You lower your mileage when you put on your air conditioner, and so you're going to lower your mileage when you do this. But what they say in these places that are selling this is you gain much more when you take this hydrogen and combine it with. We can think of this as the gasoline molecule. It has a slightly different formula, but that's when you take these two and you combine them with oxygen, then you go back this way and produce this. So you're still putting CO2 in the atmosphere, even when you combine this. It's just that for the same amount of travel, there will be less CO2 in the atmosphere. So that's the next project, Kate. Well, I thought it might be interesting to speak to the issue of should we move to the hydrogen economy, because it's possible to build an engine that will run on hydrogen. So you combine hydrogen with oxygen from the air, and you produce water, and you get. This is an exothermic reaction, produces heat and energy, so you can use it to drive the car just the way you do gasoline. And so this is one of the solutions that people are proposing, because then you're not putting CO2 in the atmosphere. And you know, it seems almost too good to be true, except for the fact that to really make it convenient, you have to drive, you want to be able to drive up to the station and get a tank of hydrogen. And in order to do that, somebody has had to use electricity to produce the hydrogen. And that's the question of whether overall, in terms of if you're using fossil fuels or coal to make this reaction go this way, then you're not really gaining too much.
Well, in that case, if you're making the electricity, why not use the electricity directly?
Right.
So if you're making the electricity from an alternative fuel source.
Yeah. And as I used to tell my students when we were studying this problem of coal, we should talk about coal and nuclear energy, about the best place to have a heat source to do what you want to do is to have a nuclear reaction and have it about 93 million miles away, which is the sun. But then the problem there is you can collect it, but you have to store it. So then you get into batteries. And how much energy does it take for the lithium and the metals that you have to go out in places like this and mine in order to produce the batteries? So,
I was going to say, getting back to storage, this is one of the arguments that they use, that one of the highest concentrations of hydrogen is water. So why go to all the trouble of storing it in pressurized tanks, which you have to carry around, when you might as well take the water and electrolyze it as you use it, and not have anything dangerous put in storage?
Yeah. And these kits, what are the fraction of gasoline that you're burning to the amount of water? It's probably 10 gallons of gas for 1 gallon of water.
Oh, it isn't that much. They say that 2 fluid ounces of water will make enough gas that when you're traveling, you can go 100 miles on 2 fluid ounces of water.
And burn only hydrogen
gas? Not only. It reduces.
I'm wondering how much gas you burn.
Well, if you're saying 50 to 80 miles per gallon.
When you come back to Holden next year, Ben will have done the experiment. He will tell you what the result was. Well, I just learned this from, I used the web a lot, I never stumbled onto this.
What do they call the kit?
One of the acronyms is gas for less, all one word, as you do in computers. If you just Google gas for less, you get this site that's selling. They sell the directions for making it,
right?
And it's all like these. The real price is $3.97, but if you order now, the price is only $97. So there, then you can buy the kits, and I don't know. Now the kits, all they consist of is a plastic container and a 2 stainless steel cylinders.
One inside the other.
One inside the other.
And spaced about a half inch apart.
Half inch apart so the water's in between so they don't short out. And then that's connected to your alternator in your car. And I imagine if they're, I suppose it's like this. And then you have a tube that's connected to this. You have a tube connected to this, and you take these, and Ben tells me that you don't separate the two gases.
You take them out in one tube.
Now, immediately that conjures up the fate of the Hindenburg. Because this is an extremely exothermic heat-producing reaction, and it also happens very fast. But one of the misconceptions of the Hindenburg is that there were some survivors. You know who they were? The ones that stayed in the cabin. Because it was not a hydrogen-oxygen explosion. The lightning ignited the canvas-painted covering of the Hindenburg. And as soon as the Hindenburg was pierced, all the hydrogen was gone. So it never exploded. And the people jumped out, fell 150 feet. That's how they died. And at the Smithsonian, they used to have an exhibit of, I'd like to travel that way rather than by airplane. They have tables and chairs like this, dining service. Seemed to me it was pretty nice.
Dining service, they don't even offer that anymore.
Well, as Ben was saying, why worry about having gas stations that can sell you hydrogen? Why not do this and work toward less and less use of gasoline? And I think, I don't know whether this will take off or not, but it'll be interesting to see what happens to this technology.
You know, it's fascinating to think that it wouldn't be more popular than it is, because the hybrid engines, just the development of the hybrid engines, I think the newest versions are actually a consortium of four or five different auto manufacturers. They're so expensive to develop, and yet the mileage for a hybrid is almost half what you're claiming here.
Right, right. And that whole technology of batteries and the mechanics of switching from the electrical power to the gas engine, or here is you use the same engine.
Yeah.
So it's it just seems got to be something wrong with it. It seems to be true.
I haven't tried it.
Consumers Report had done a bunch of tests. They said there are no devices that'll help mileage.
Yeah. Yeah.
They said,
well, they told Henry Ford, you'll never be able to sell those cars, you know. So I thought I'd take a little bit of your time and just tell you what I know about when are we going to actually run out of petroleum? That's been an issue. So first of all, the petroleum occurs in cavities of different sizes in rocks where muds, like the ones settling out of the water in the Gulf of Mexico and off a lot of shorelines, where small organisms like plankton, microscopic and millimeter size, and larger aquatic life is being trapped. And as that is buried, the protein in that is converted, depending on how deep you bury it, to various organic molecules, all of which are liquid. Now, someone brought a rock yesterday, were intrigued by a sandstone that was full of beautiful little black lines. Rocks are not impermeable. They are porous, and even a granite, if you wait long enough, water will seep through it, because there are natural boundaries between the minerals. And some rocks are less porous than others. Now, a sandstone, if it is just an accumulation of sand grains, and you look at a cross-section of it, you don't have to draw too many of these to recognize that there's a certain amount of pore space. In fact, you can end up calculating that once you know how to calculate the area of the circle. And it turns out that for any system that has in two-dimensional circles, you will have 35% void space. And now, if the sand grains are tight, then this is a porous rock, because it'll hold up, but there's no way to get it in and out. So that we call permeability. So now if you have a rock that you had calcium as a dissolved ion, and you had CO2 in the water, that can combine and form this mineral calcite. And if the sand was forming when this was also forming, you might have calcite in here between the grains as well as in the void space. And geologists, when they map rocks, they have to list poorly cemented, well cemented. Calcite is a much softer mineral than quartz, which is these sand grains, or feldspar, which are the sand grains, and it's very susceptible to fluids. So if acid waters at slightly high temperature percolate through from the surface down and back up, they may dissolve out the calcite, and then you've got void space between these, and the sandstone becomes very permeable. The mudstone has neither much pore space, nor is it very permeable. But it has these organisms, and once there's a fluid in there, if it gets buried deeper, the fluid gets pressed up, just like you squeeze water out of a sponge. And it migrates through the geologic system. You had a mud here and a sandstone here, but it would get pressed up and the oil would end up there. And if there's any water in the system, you know that oil floats on water. So the oil moves in regions where there are eventual cavities in the rock. And these can become very large when there are dislocations, when you bury rocks. And those are called oil pools. And it's amazing how you can go from the microscopic scale here to something that is millions of cubic feet of space, that's say 80% oil and a few sand grains and so forth floating in it. Saudi Arabia, you know, has come into focus in the world's economy because in the 1930s, after an arrangement was reached with the first king of Saudi Arabia and the oil companies, they discovered this biggest oil field, still essentially the largest oil field, although there now is some indication that ones in the Gulf of Mexico may be as large, and they're finding some in Russia. When these pools are first tapped, they're frequently under pressure. So you've all seen pictures of gushers. But once that pressure is gone, then you have to pump the oil. And when you get the reservoir about half empty, it becomes more, you have to use more energy to get the oil out because you don't have the overpressure of the oil in the system. And it appears that worldwide, many oil pools are essentially abandoned when they're half empty because it's cheaper to find a new pool and pump it up. And in the literature now, there is a debate whether the Saudis are letting the world market know that it is becoming more expensive for them to pump oil. They say, you know, we still have a lot of oil and we can meet the supply and demand. We have this way of operating in an orderly manner through OPEC and so forth. But they're probably, you know, nearly where it's half empty. So, to my mind, since we've been living on oil for so many years, and it is so convenient, and so many, well, I shouldn't say so many, some people are making fantastic amount of money from it, I doubt that our use of oil for transportation in individual automobiles is going to disappear. It's just too convenient. The best way to circulate energy, even though it's not the most ecological way to use energy, I think the sun and photoelectric cells and electricity is the environmental way to go. But for convenience, gas is, it's rather amazing. I don't think Henry Ford sat around thinking, I won't be able to sell these cars. There aren't any gas stations. In less than half a decade, every little place, the little towns throughout all of America, had four or five gas stations. Simply because you had to, it's very easy to put a tank on a railroad car, put a tank on a truck, and store this, and put a tank on the car. It's just too convenient. So, how much oil is left? Well, you can go on Google, and you can Google the King Hubbard Peak. In the 1950s, he began to be concerned about ways in the United States to continue to find more and more oil, as we were particularly after the Second World War, when we began building freeways, and in addition to cars, we had campers and so forth. So he plotted the amount of oil found, beginning in about the 1850s in Pennsylvania, where it was used as kerosene. More uses were found for it, which meant that more people looked for more of it, and there was a constant increase. And his data in, make this a little more, oh, that's all right, but this is curves. And 1963, he saw that we were approaching the point where this is going up very quickly, and not only is it increasing, but the increase is increasing. If this is a resource, which eventually you're going to use it all up, and then either it's going to come down like this, or it's going to come down like this, or it's going to come down like that, but you're going to reach some peak when essentially it's all gone, there will come a time when this is not increasing like this, and the increase levels off, and this starts to go this way. In other words, the curve is like this, and then it tails off, and there is what is called an inflection point, when the rate of increase decreases. And if you know that, and you assume that you have a symmetrical bell curve, you can predict this point where you're essentially going to be out of what you've been plotting. And in 1963, he said that in 1973, the United States was going to be in trouble. Now, he didn't say worldwide. This is just based on the oil that could be found in the United States. And how many of you remember lining up at the gas stations in 73? Why did it go away? It went away because the market adjusted, and we began to buy more foreign oil. But it took time for that to adjust. In less than a few years, however, and we're just back on, instead of using U.S. oil, we were using oil from Saudi Arabia, principally, and South America, and Russia. So based on these curves, various geologists, various reputations have predicted when we're really going to run out of oil. And they started doing that. Some of them said in 2004 in 1990. And of course we got to know 2004, and we still have a lot of oil. So now planners, politicians, and economists and so forth say, you know, no point in listening to geologists because they don't know what they're talking about anyhow. They don't distinguish between geologist A and geologist B. Why is this resource plot on a curve like this? And just we'll finish off with that. Actually, you can do this better at the dinner table. Let's just make the area of this circle essentially the same as the area of the United States. Where did I start? So that's the area of the United States. And now let's say at depth, and we don't know where exactly, but there are pools of oil in here. Scattered around various sizes. And the number probably of the smaller ones is probably greater than the number of the big ones, simply because this migration from the muds in the cavities is never complete. So the oil pools maybe have exaggerated the number here, but just to illustrate this. Now, if you know nothing about this, and you're going to drill, so you just put down at random, you just go in and go like this, all of a sudden you're wasting a lot of money. But your probability of finding something there, if you have to go down and you hit that, the radius of that of the pool, the area is pi r squared in the pool, and the probability of hitting that is simply the area of the circle. So this is pi times the square of the radius of the USA. And so the probability, of course, is greatest for the large pools. So that's why that curve goes up like this. And it wouldn't go up if there wasn't a demand for the oil. That's the other part of why it goes up, because you're looking for it. But eventually, when you hit these little ones, not bad. I'll just end with this. The geologists who made money telling people where to drill were ones who had an idea, an understanding of what ways that you could form a pool. And one of them is if you take rocks and fold them like this, and do that in three dimensions, you will not just have an arch, you will have a dome. And because of the deformation here, you get fractured rock up at the top. And so this is where, if you had muds here and sandstones here, the oil would migrate up into those fractures. So that's where a pool forms. Now, we had a geologist in our department who did his thesis in the 1930s on granites, rocks that you might find gold in. But there were no jobs looking for gold at that time. So he went down to Texas and Oklahoma and so forth and looked for the evidence at the surface of domes in three dimension, or these folded anticlines, as they're called, in two dimensions. Now notice what happens if you have a sequence of rocks, and they're all a part of a folded terrain. The deeper it is, the basic structures down here, it slowly becomes less obvious. And he had a young daughter, and he probably read to her the story of the princess and the pea. And you stacked mattresses, no matter how many they put, you'd still feel the pea under the mattress. Well, notice that what he was measuring is the angle between the horizontal and the inclination of that bed. And you'll notice that as you get further and further away, the angle becomes less and less. And if you're in an area where these rocks eventually aren't folded, well, then they essentially the angle is zero. So in Oklahoma and Texas, Kansas, he went around very carefully measuring. And most geologists at the time were using a handheld compass. If you have a slab, you see a slab of rock jutting out in a road cut, and it is inclined like this. If you have a level, you can find a level direction on this. Geologists call that the strike. You see, if this were like this, the strike would be north-south. It's like this, it's east-west. So first you get that measurement, and that is a horizontal line. There will only be one where it's actually horizontal. This is the first thing you learn in the geology field camp. You carefully find that, and then you want the angle between the horizontal and this. And in general, the geologists were measuring that to plus or minus about 10 degrees. Very sloppy measurements, but they weren't thinking that, well, maybe I could use this if I were a little more careful. And he started measuring things down to less than 5 degrees. And he found these subtle places where he told the company that he was consulting for, drill there. Now, a successful geologist, as an exploration geologist, if one hole out of 10 was a find, then you developed a reputation. Because the economics of drilling is such that you can spend a lot of money on 9 holes if the 10th one paid off. And he was able to better that to 6, 7 or so. Became very wealthy. Did not give a penny back to the Department of Geology and Geophysics. That's how oil was found in Texas. Now we have more sophisticated ways of doing it. But that is why this curve went up, because he found these larger ones first and then get smaller and smaller. And then this curve goes off like that. The difference between this curve and this is this inflection. So I think we should go to supper.
Do they have a current estimate on where the peak might be?
The
peak? Where the
peak. Yeah. The latest things published went from 204 to 210, 220. Geologists began to get the feeling at the turn of the century that they knew where there were places that had pools. Mm-hmm. Now, Minnesota has sandstones and these mudstones and limestones, except it's right on the feather edge of those rocks. And so there have been some speculative drilling, but you can be pretty well assured nobody's ever going to find oil in Minnesota. Now, Iowa is a different question. And, I don't, there aren't any active wells I know of in Iowa. Now, in North Dakota, there's a great boom because their rocks are part of the rocks that come out to the Rockies and are pushed up. But there are places there where the rocks have been filling in a basin called the Williston Basin. I have a feeling that the Williston Basin is an old meteorite impact scar. Maybe we'll learn that as we go further. Well, because so many things like that have been found further offshore, and now the Russians have found new things in Kazakhstan, you don't see geologists making predictions now. But it doesn't negate the fact that it's a finite resource, because it takes 10 million years or so to form the oil, that we're going to use it up. And the same thing applies to coal.
Will we be able to breathe the air while we're still trying to use up the supply of the air that's for us?
Well, that's the thing. It's an engineering problem. I'll end with this story. Ben and I were standing on the streets of North South Dakota in this little tights, 5 or 6 years old, enough to be able to hear adult conversation. We might have heard a conversation like this. One farmer says to the other, as a Model T is coming down the road, "Well, I'm going to get one of those. You know, they're only $600. In our crop last year, we made about $800. And my wife will just wait for the house. We won't add that room that she wants, you know, in those cars." And the other one says, "What do you want to do that for?" And he says, "Well, then I don't have to feed it oats. I don't have to take it out. I don't have to care for it. It's just there." And then the other one says, "Well, yes, but have you heard about Al who broke his arm cranking it, trying to get it start, which frequently happened?" And then a horse and buggy comes by. And the horse drops its load on the street. Farmer said, "And we won't have to take care of that anymore either." Little did either one of them know that was what was coming out of the back of that Model T was far worse than what that horse was leaving behind. So the question, you got too many cars in one place, that's bad. Well, in this the little tank, you're reducing the amount of gas you're burning because you are using the water. And if you can increase gradually the amount of water, you're moving toward a hydrogen car. You're never going to get there completely because of the way you say it. You have to use electricity to produce that.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.